This is Central Time. The U.S. population grew by just over 7% during the last decade. That number from the census is important for a lot of reasons, including how many seats in the House of Representatives each state gets, a process that's known as reapportionment. Florida, Montana, and Colorado are among the six states that will be gaining seats. Texas got two extra. Illinois, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and a few others will be losing a state. Wisconsin, we hold steady for the next decade. Eight members in the House. This also determines our electoral college votes. States now begin the process of redrawing their new districts. One Democratic-backed group has already filed lawsuits aimed at having that redistricting done by a nonpartisan court in three states. There is some lawyering up going on here in Wisconsin as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about how census turns into congressional seats and how those get sorted out? What do you think changes will mean for control of the House and how things get done there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Reed Wilson is back with us, national correspondent at The Hill. Reed, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks, Rob. You know, this is like Christmas morning for me. I love new census numbers.
Yeah, you described it in one piece as like the NCAA basketball tournament bracket being announced, but it's just once every 10 years. As someone who covers both state politics, Reed, and the census, this is an exciting time of year for you.
It is. And, you know, there are always surprises, just like that NCAA tournament. And this year we had some real surprises, too. First of all, you mentioned that, you know, the U.S. grew at a 7.4% rate over the last decade. That's the second slowest rate that we've ever grown in any census going back to 1790. The only other time we grew slower was in the 1930s, of course, following the Great Depression. One of the things that just struck me so much about all of these numbers is just how much we're still living with the cultural, economic, and sociological hangover of the Great Recession that happened more than a decade ago.
Now, a weird thing here is you might see a state lose a seat like California did. That doesn't mean their population went down. Their population went up, I checked, but slower than the nation as a whole. Or you could look at a state like West Virginia where they lost a seat and their population did go down. What's going on there?
So there's a very complicated formula that is way beyond my own very limited mathematical capabilities to explain. But the gist is effectively when reapportionment happens, what they're doing is they're giving out the 435 seats that are in the U.S. House of Representatives. So we start with the first 50. Every state gets at least one. And then they determine the next several, or the next, you know, 385 seats based on the relative sizes of population. So California is the largest seat, so they get seat number 51. Then, based on the formula, Texas gets seat number 52. And we allocate those all the way down to number 435 based on population. And if a state is growing but not rapidly enough to maintain their margins, then they can lose a state like California. And by the way, I think it's four of the other six states that lost a member of Congress. It had actually gained population over the last 10 years. It just hadn't gained enough to keep where they were. On the other hand, states that grow more by a smaller margin, but still by a higher percentage, can gain seats based on sort of moving up in that order of priority. So in this case, as I'm looking at sort of the what you might call the last five in and the first five out, a state like Arizona, which is growing rapidly, narrowly missed adding a tenth seat, whereas a state like Montana, which grew by a smaller overall margin but by a higher percentage than Arizona, they gained a second seat rather than staying at just one seat for the next decade.
And speaking of narrow margins, there were a couple places where, 90 people or just a couple hundred people one way or the other would have made the difference between losing a seat or not?
Right. So this is a part of that very complex formula. If this U.S. Census had found 89 more people in the state of New York, New York would have kept all 27 members of its House of Representatives, of its congressional delegation. But because they fell short, they fall down to 26 members. They would have gotten the 436th seat. They're the ones, you know, right there on the bubble, the ones whose hearts get broken at tournament time, if you will. On the other hand, now, okay, you think 86 or 89 seats as people is narrow. Minnesota kept its eighth congressional seat by just 26 people. So imagine that. You fill a Greyhound bus half full of, you know, hot dish bearing Minnesotans and send them out to Buffalo, New York. And all of a sudden, Buffalo or New York keeps a seat and Minnesota loses one. So that's how narrowly some of these states get decided. Now, I will say it has the margins between the last seat in and the first seat out have never been that close in the modern history of the census.
Now, this census shuffled things less than usual, but I think people look at this and say, okay, do Republicans or Democrats benefit? And loosely, it seems like Democratic states lost a few seats, Republican states, especially Texas, Florida, you know, that's a few there. Is it that simple? Republicans won a little bit and Democrats lost a little bit?
No, it's far more complicated than that. So let's take a look at, say, two states that lost seats, a state like New York and a state like Pennsylvania. In both cases, there's states that went for President Biden in 2020, states, or at least Pennsylvania, went for President Trump in 2016. So one swing state, one pretty blue state. You got to take a look at where the populations are shifting there. And as I talk to my sources here, they're telling me that the population in Pennsylvania is bleeding out of the Northeast. Imagine like Joe Biden's hometown, Scranton, Pennsylvania. That's the area that's losing population, whereas places like Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, more Democratic bastions, are gaining population. So as the legislature and the governor start negotiating where congressional seats move there, they may decide that it's a Republican seat that doesn't have enough population and has to be split between, say, three other Democratic seats, or maybe they create a swing competitive district up there. In New York, it's very likely that the upstate area, which is where the very few Republicans left in New York, is the area that's going to lose a seat. So in that case, it could be a Republican who loses a seat. But even in states where you're not likely to where the delegation size won't change, you could see a shift in the congressional lines. Now, in a place like Wisconsin, you could see that imagine that legislative Republicans might take a look at, say, a district held by Congressman Ron Kind, who lives out west. He's got one of the few districts that a Democrat won that President Trump also won in 2020. If Republicans decide they want to mess with Congressman Kind's lines, well, they've got a chance of picking up a seat, even if the Republicans didn't, or even if the state delegation didn't grow or shrink. So really, this is like, not to keep with my basketball analogy here, but this is the tip-off. And now the game begins, and the two sides are going to try to manipulate all their district lines left and right and try to make some significant moves here. It may be the case that the biggest shifts that we see take place in states that did not gain or lose seats and just have more creative cartographers.
We're talking to Reed Wilson, national correspondent at The Hill, about reapportionment, which states are gaining and losing seats in the House based on U.S. Census numbers. You could join in with your thoughts or questions about how it all works at 800-642-1234. Coming up, how the lines get drawn in Wisconsin and different states. It's different from place to place. Share your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Reed Wilson, national correspondent at The Hill, looking at which states will gain or lose seats in Congress for the next decade and the process of drawing the borders for these new districts. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Reed, drawing the lines, you were just starting to talk about that here in Wisconsin, Republican legislature, Democratic governor. Are we in that boat with a lot of different states right now?
Yeah, and you mentioned earlier that the Democratic the outside group that oversees redistricting has already filed suit in three states. It's Minnesota, North Carolina, and Louisiana. You can imagine that a lawsuit is coming to Wisconsin, too. This is, you know, Governor Evers and the legislature have not exactly been the best of friends in the last couple of years, to put it mildly. So you can imagine that they're probably not in a mood to get along terribly well. Now, I will say one interesting thing that tends to happen. This is a process that the legislature controls, not Congress, not anybody else. It's the state legislature who controls it. So in some cases over the last couple of decades, a really interesting thing we've seen is that the legislature will say, meh, we don't really care about the congressional stuff. You guys do what you want. We're just going to pass your map in a way that we all can get along and agree with. And we'll focus the real fight on the battle over the state legislature, because, of course, that's their seats that they're fighting over rather than the congressional seats. In some other states, what you frequently see is senior legislative members, and the clever ones at least, drawing districts that just happen to favor themselves if they decide they want a promotion to run for Congress too. I haven't heard any buzz on that in Wisconsin. As a matter of fact, I talked to Speaker Voss about this a couple of months ago, and he told me he basically didn't see a huge impetus for change in the districts as they're currently drawn. We'll see what the tune is when he and Governor Evers get together in a room together. But basically, you know, these things, they don't always work out the way you might think. Redistricting becomes an intensely personal issue, especially when one member of Congress wants one particular school district or church or whatever drawn into his or her district. I remember hearing about a fight about 10 years ago in Illinois where they had drawn the entire map and they were just about to finalize it when one member of Congress threw a fit because there was not a very particular monument in the city of Chicago drawn into his district. So they had to go back in and change the district lines by two blocks. That's it. Before they could finalize the map. So it's like the ultimate backroom deal, but boy, it can get real personal real fast.
So we're going to call her. Janet is with us in Reedsburg. Janet, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to bring up, Janet?
With all of the deaths from COVID across the United States, how many 100,000 deaths do they say now?
550,000 plus.
500,000, yeah. That certainly affected the population since the census. Is that taken into consideration even when what was your announcement that the population only grew by 7% since all of those deaths taken into consideration since?
Janet, thanks for the call. And the census was taken in the midst of COVID, Reed. Did it, apart from obviously the tragic deaths that we saw, did it end up affecting the final count here?
So that is an excellent question, Janet. And the U.S. Census is a snapshot in time. And the snapshot that they take is aimed at April 1st, 2020. So everybody who was alive on April 1st, 2020, they try to factor those people in and find them, and that's who gets counted. If you... I hate to be super crass about this, but if you die on March 31st, you don't count. And if you die on April 2nd, you do count. That's just the way the census has been, the law has been written since the 1929, when the sort of the modern foundation of the census was created. In rolling out the numbers yesterday, the Census Bureau folks were saying that this is the greatest challenge that they've ever experienced. Now, ordinarily, mounting the U.S. Census is the largest mobilization of government workers in peacetime. It's like basically the biggest thing the United States government does except go to war. And this time around, they had to totally reinvent everything on the fly. I mean, they were starting to send out the census pamphlets. I'm sure most listeners got, their postcard in the mail about a week before everything went into lockdown. Now, the vast majority of people this time around answered their census online, which is great, makes the census's job a lot easier. But you still have to send people out. So if the house at 123 Main Street doesn't respond, you've still got to send what they call an enumerator, the actual person who sits there and counts people, out to that door to knock on the door to ask how many people live in this house. And, there were a lot of communities where if you knocked on a door, you were not terribly welcome in the midst of a pandemic. Mm-hmm. So the Bureau has had to deal with this a lot. They spent a long time yesterday answering questions about their confidence in the figures. But at the moment, I hate to be so crass about it, but the 550,000 people who have passed away because of the coronavirus, the vast majority of them would have been counted in the census because they were alive on April 1st, 2020, and that's officially Census Day.
Thanks for that call. And Reed, that's all the time we have. I'm sure we'll talk to you more about this over the next few months. Thanks for joining us again.
I love it, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Reed Wilson is a national correspondent at The Hill. He talked to us about which states will gain and lose seats in the House of Representatives and how they'll hash out where the boundary lines will be drawn. Coming up after the news, hummingbirds are starting to show up around Wisconsin. We'll talk about their spring migration. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Have you seen any hummingbirds this spring? If not, it shouldn't be too much longer. The hummingbird central spring migration map shows them mainly in the southeastern quadrant of the U.S., along with a handful of sightings around Wisconsin. Many make their way north from Mexico and Central America, then head back in the fall. The tiny birds are pretty remarkable. Take the ruby-throated hummingbird. According to the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, its heart beats about 225 times a minute while resting, while flying 1,200 times a minute. By comparison, the human heart averages only about 70 beats per minute. Their wings move up and down about 55 times per second. That's fast enough that it produces its own sound. Check this out. Hence the name. It's humming. Because of their size, they're not the easiest birds in the world to spot, but making your home more appealing to them, even if you live in an apartment, can be pretty easy. Mickey O'Connor is an avian zookeeper at the Milwaukee County Zoo and one of three licensed hummingbird banders in Wisconsin. Mickey, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, is this the time of year, Mickey, if we want to welcome hummingbirds to our home to get the feeders out?
Yes, I'm anxiously awaiting my first one. I heard a report today that one was spotted in Glendale, Wisconsin, which isn't too far from me. So I have my feeder out, and I'm waiting anxiously to see my first one for the year.
And I've been reading, putting out a feeder, we don't want to just do it casually, right? It's kind of a commitment. We want to make sure we keep up with it. Why is that important?
Yeah, feeders are tricky. It's a great way to attract them and keep them around your yard, but they do require a lot of work. It's no different than having a nest box. You want to clean them. And with hummingbird feeders, because it's a sugar water, a 4-to-1 ratio, it can ferment and spoil rather quickly, especially if it gets warm or it's in the sun. So generally, you want to clean them every 2 to 3 days, depending on the weather. And another easier way for those that don't have time to keep their feeders clean is to just plant lots of flowers. They love salvias, and there's all kinds of different flowers that will attract them. And that is a more natural food source for them.
Let's talk a little more about that, because I think a lot of people are figuring out what they want to plant this year. What are some other good ingredients in a hummingbird-friendly garden patch?
So there's a, if you Google that, you'll find all kinds of options, but there's plants in the Cuphea family, C-U-P-H-E-A family. Bee balm or Monarda is a really popular plant. There's beard tongue, there's flowering tobacco, vervain, turtle heads. So I could go on and on. But they also, in addition to flowers, they do need other things to make your yard friendly to them. Trees and shrubs, so a variation of different types of habitats, will encourage them to nest as well.
And speaking of making a friendly yard for hummingbirds, windows, I understand, are a big hazard. How can we make sure that our hummingbird friends can avoid collisions?
Yes, windows are definitely a hazard for most birds, and hummingbirds are one of them, especially our migratory birds, which the ruby throat is. If you go on AmericanBirdConservancy.org, they have some wonderful options that you can check out depending on your window and what you might find aesthetically pleasing. But there's featherfriendly.org is a really good application. It's little square dots. You can have fun things to do with the kids. You can do decals or do some paint that's washable. You can have some fun designs. So you can make it a fun time for the kids. And help birds at the same time. And this is incredibly important year-round, but especially in migration.
We're talking to Mickey O'Connor, avian zookeeper at the Milwaukee County Zoo and one of three licensed hummingbird banders in Wisconsin. All right, let's talk about that role as a hummingbird bander. What does that mean?
Sure. So hummingbird banding is a rather specialized tool. One of the reasons we band birds, hummingbirds, as well as songbirds, is it is an educational tool, but from the science perspective, we can help because the band has an individual number on it for the actual bird that it's going on. We can learn about longevity, site fidelity, how dedicated they are to their sites, migration routes, timing, the patterns of migration. When you have a bird in the hand, it's a great opportunity to get an overall condition of the bird. Weight is a really good indication of how well the bird is doing. The plumage, if there's any deformities in the beak, mites, things like that. Also, we're looking at winter and migratory stopover sites. We do get other species of hummingbirds other than the ruby throat, but the ruby-throated hummingbird is the only one that nests here. Other birds you might see are Anna's and Rufus, and we also had an Allen's this winter.
Now, I watched a video of you banding a hummingbird, and it seems to me that this would be really hard to do because hummingbirds, I've come to learn, are really small. I would not have the eye-hand coordination to pull this off. How hard is this to do?
It is a definite skill. To give you an idea, there are more than a couple thousand people who band songbirds, but as far as banding hummingbirds, there's only about 150 of us in the U.S. and Canada combined, and you do have to have specialized training through the U.S. Geological Survey. That's who issues your permits and supplies you your bands. It's quite a dedication because we have to actually hand cut and make our own bands for each hummingbird. Sounds complicated, but once you get it down, it's pretty easy. They are tiny. Male might weigh as much as a penny, so that gives you an idea how small they are. But once you learn, they're little, but they're tough little birds. I mean, one of the reasons I love them is they're so naughty. I mean, I'm sure everybody has seen them chasing, and they're very territorial, and they're always chasing each other, so they're a lot of fun to watch. But as far as the traps go, we just set up a trap, and they simply fly in, and we immediately remove them from the trap. It's like holding a big dragonfly or something, to give a comparison, and you just gently put them in a little sack. And the banding only takes 2 minutes or less. It's a very quick process. And when we're banding, what we do is we take many measurements. We're going to measure the bill. We're going to measure the tail. And then, of course, we put the band on and we get the weight. And then we just look at the overall condition of the bird. So it's a very quick process.
I wanted to ask you about the migration of the hummingbird, especially the ruby-throated one that we see most commonly here in Wisconsin. These little guys go a long way. Can you talk about their migration path?
Well, that's one of the reasons we're banding here is there's been little banding of hummingbirds in the state of Wisconsin. So that's one of the reasons this began and to look at winter hummingbirds as well. We don't really know where Wisconsin hummingbirds are going. So there's many hummingbird banders down south. So we're hoping that the more bands we get on these birds that we'll start getting some feedback. I was very fortunate. I have one banding site in Whitewater and another one at my neighbor's house up in Winter, Wisconsin on Connors Lake. And I caught an adult female. And it turns out during fall migration, a couple years prior to that, I had caught this bird as a chick. So we had our like first connection of, and that's about, I don't know how many miles. It's almost a straight line though from Winter to Whitewater. So that was like my first line of a migration route in Wisconsin. And then we had another individual who banded a hummingbird in Texas, and it was caught, I believe, up in Rhinelander. So once again, now we're starting to establish some lines of migration so we can understand where our quote unquote Wisconsin hummingbirds are going.
And ruby-throated hummingbirds nest here in Wisconsin. Is it likely we're ever actually going to lay eyes on a nest unless we're looking really hard for them?
You can, if you know, especially if you're spending time in your own property and you're watching a female and you actually keep tabs on her. Their nest is small. It's about the size of a small walnut. There's two tiny eggs in it generally, and it can be anywhere from 6 to 60 feet up in the tree. They like a horizontal-ish branch that's kind of downsloping a little bit. And unfortunately, just in passing, it looks like a little nub. So unless you happen to be looking and see the female go to it, that's probably your best chance. I personally have only seen it twice, and once was pointed out to me. So it is difficult. But they do nest, you know, in just urban backyards. So it's very possible you could have one.
Now, you mentioned ruby-throated hummingbirds. They're the ones most common here in Wisconsin. They're not the only game in town. Who else shows up from time to time?
So Rufus hummingbirds are more of a West Coast bird. They typically nest in southern Alaska, and they're done nesting, you know, in, I think, late May. So we have had, as early as June, a Rufus hummingbird visit Wisconsin. Now, traditionally, they're migration is to go south to Mexico. But for some reason, some of these Rufus hummingbirds do an elliptical migration. So they kind of grow across the top of the continent as far as the East Coast sometimes, and then down south. A friend of mine who bands in Tallahassee, Florida, he actually banded a Rufous hummingbird, and it was caught 5 months later by another bander in Prince William Sound, Alaska, which is over 3,500 miles away. And the bird was fine. It was caught by another bander. She took measurements and let it go. And he also had another one that went directly west from the Florida area to Southern California, which is about 1,900 miles. So these birds are doing these amazing migration routes, and without banding them, we never would have learned this information. Why they're doing it, we don't know, but they are doing it. And then we just had an Allens this winter that Cynthia Bridge was able to band. And we've had Annas. And again, we're not really sure why these birds are ending up here, but they are. And when we catch them, at least so far, they've been healthy and just migrating through our state for whatever reason.
Say insects will fly from plant to plant and help pollinate them. Do hummingbirds serve as pollinators too?
They do to some degree. The cardinal flower, in particular, it seems to be a good pollinator plant for them. They feed on so many flowers, up to 1,500 flowers a day is what the experts say that they need to sustain themselves. So that's one of the reasons feeders and lots of flowers that we plant are helpful to them, because they do need the nectar, but they predominantly are eating insects. So a lot of your plants, including flowering plants, are attracting tiny insects from mosquitoes to gnats. And those hummingbirds are eating a tremendous amount of insects, especially when they're feeding their young.
And Mickey, as we wrap up, when is peak ruby-throated hummingbird season in Wisconsin, when we're most likely to see them?
I think mid to late May. I mean, they'll start actually built may have eggs in a nest by the 3rd, maybe the 24th of May, as far, and they can go into July. The latest documented nest with eggs in it was August 5th. So they can go pretty late because they're already starting to migrate at that point, at least the males. So I would say mid-May for sure. The bulk of the guys should at least be here, at least. And then some of them are continuing north. Some of them are going way farther than here. So they're just passing through. So they may not get up to, northern Wisconsin until more like the 3rd week of May or so.
Mickey, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Mickey O'Connor is an avian zookeeper at the Milwaukee County Zoo and one of three licensed hummingbird banders in Wisconsin. We talked to her about hummingbird spring migration into the state and how to attract them into our yards.